Stay tuned. It's the second hour of the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show here on KSCO. Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the show. Have you ever argued with yourself? Do you know who you were arguing with when you were arguing with yourself? Have you ever seen movies where you have like a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other, and both of them telling you something to do in a difficult situation? What's the reality of this? Is there really subparts of our personality that we talk to, which we can have a dialogue with? Well, these questions and more have been addressed in a new book called Your Symphony of Selves by James Fadiman and Jordan Gruber. Now on the line, we have Jordan Gruber to discuss this view of psychology and whether or not it is valid to think of ourselves as multiple personalities. Is that even an accurate way to think about it today? Jordan, welcome to the show.
Oh, hello, Alan. Thank you so much for having me on, and it's going to be great to talk with you. I'm excited.
Yeah, good. Well, tell us a little bit about this book and how you're focusing on a new way of looking at who is this I. How did it come about?
Well, there's the historical fact that I heard Jim Fadiman give a talk about this in around 1990 at Forrest Gamble's Mind Center. And Jim had been working on it a long time, and then Jim and I became close friends and did other things. But I knew he had always been working on this, and in fact, Jim's a big fan of William James, and what he now says in the reader note at the very beginning of the book is that one thing we realized is that it's not really a new idea at all. This was the standard conventional view of mainstream American psychology as represented by William James in 1890. He talked very explicitly about social selves, about how we all have as many different parts of ourselves as there are where we put ourselves and interact with people and they regard us in certain ways and we interact with them. And we think he basically had it right. And then for historical reasons involving Freud and Charcot and other people, the idea was suppressed, so you only see it in the context of it being multiple personality disorder or dissociative identity disorder, as it's now called. And you see it in novels like Sybil and The Three Faces of Eve.
Right.
But for Jim, since he started thinking about this, and I won't tell you when that was, it was very clear to him that healthy multiplicity is the reality of most of us most of the time.
Okay, because the normal right now is what you're calling single self assumption?
Well, yeah. So here's the thing. This idea is not new, okay? Plato talks about this. And certainly modern people like internal family systems and psychosynthesis and Gurdjieff and Jean Houston and Sri Aurobindo, on and on. A lot of people have pieces of this. But as a general philosophical and psychiatric and religious principle, the idea is that we have one self. Everybody's in agreement. But for Jim, and now for me too, it's clear that actually that's just not true at all. What's really true is that I'm in many ways a different person when I'm hanging out with my old friends and partying than I am if I'm with my parents or at my daughter's school.
Sure, the different aspects of your personality come out depending on who you're associating with.
Well, that's exactly right. Different parts of you are drawn out and you interact with each other.
Yeah.
But what we want to say is that once you take the single self assumption, which is that you are or ought to be a single self, if you question that assumption even a little bit in your own life and start playing with the possibility that since you're really not in the self that gets along with your partner right now and they're always in the self that fights with you, if either one of you just shifts into a different self rather than gets triggered or switched into the self that always fights, things will go a lot better.
Well, how does this relate to our understanding of moods? Because it seems like moods bring up different aspects of one's self.
The clearest answer I've heard to this came from a receptionist at our publisher, which is Inner Traditions.
Yeah.
This was early on, and she was talking to us, and she was like, I'm trying to understand what this is about. Are you saying that when I go pick up my daughter at daycare, and all of a sudden I'm not in this professional persona, and I'm kind of cracking jokes and taking care and focused, that I'm really kind of a different person? And we said, yeah, and if you were in a good mood or a bad mood, you would still be in that different part of who you are when you went to pick up your daughter. So I kind of like to think of moods as bigger picture, filling in things that are affecting you. It may be we're all in sort of a depressed and crazy mood now because of the virus and lockdown, but it's not just mood. You know, you said earlier that we have a new theory. We like to say we don't have a theory. We have three premises and a couple of assumptions, and that a theory is way beyond our pay grade as, you know, as is a lot of things in this whole area. Huh. The three premises are that healthy, normal people like you and me have more than one self. Mm-hmm. And the second premise is that different selves are truly different. They're unique. They have inherent value. They often have their own agendas. They want to do things you don't want to do. And we're back to those questions. You started reading one. Yeah. If you've ever argued with yourself and Shane Sides, who did that? When looking at that last cookie or piece of cake or candy, who says yes and who says no? So we know our different selves, and they have different agendas. And a really important point that wasn't understood till the 1980s is that attempts to fuse or combine different selves and make one of them go away almost never work. It almost always backfires. It's like trying to push a bubble under a blanket and it pops up, or in a pool with a beach ball. You just can't do that. The premises, again, one is that everybody has selves, although there are people who have selves that are sick or unhappy, and that's where we do get into pathology. The second is that your selves are truly different, innately valuable, and have their own agendas and can't be just gotten rid of. And the third is that ultimately it's cheap and easy to verify for yourself whether you can see beyond the single self assumption and start playing with this and see whether or not your life really does begin to work better. So our kind of view is that once we get people seriously thinking about this, kind of the camel nose under the tent, and they get what we're talking about, it makes a lot of things much more understandable, and it gives people permission to be the best parts of who they are and to work with the worst parts of who they are.
But you have to get to know these selves, right? You have to.
Yeah.
I guess we'll talk a little bit about that after the break. We got to go to a commercial break. We're talking to Jordan Gruber on his new book with Jim Fadiman called Your Symphony of Selves. Be right back. That's a good question, Mrs. Future. Hey, Jordan. We're talking to Jordan Gruber on Your Symphony of Selves, a new book he's written with Dr. James Fadiman on how we're actually all healthy multiple personalities in a way. And what comes to mind is how this evolves. How does this evolve? We saw a movie called Inside Out a few years ago from Pixar that portrayed a young girl who had several little beings that kind of lived in her head that helped direct her activities from moment to moment. Are you familiar with that film?
Oh, sure. We saw the film, and we wanted to put a picture of it, but of course you can't do that. You know, they have an interesting way of talking about the personifying each of the emotions as sort of being its own person. And that's a little unfair in that the different selves you have, most of them will kind of have their own set and range of emotions. So it's a little bit, but it did get people thinking about it.
Yeah.
Just like all the crazy movies, like where...
Sybil and stuff like that.
No. The more recent one, where I'm just thinking about the three of them came together. It was Bruce Willis and...
Glass.
Yeah, those whole movies, you know, it's like this notion, and you see it in Doom Patrol 2, one of the characters, she has 62 different personalities, and each one has its own superpower, right? So this idea kind of goes back to Billy Milligan. There was a book written by Keyes, who wrote Flowers for Algernon.
Yes.
And it's called The Minds of Billy Milligan, and it's a very detailed psychiatric and police record of this fellow with 23 different personalities and how they dialogue. And one of them, he had super strength, because he had read a book on adrenaline. And he could fluently speaks Serbo-Croatian, and he was a really fine painter. People would pay him thousands of dollars for the stuff he did in prison. So he did some bad things. He committed rape, and he went to jail for the rest of his life. But the way his cells talk to each other and the way they interact, you begin to get a feeling how in different cells you really kind of are a different person. And I can give you a couple of examples of that. In one of them, now I have to say that we talk about the pathological versions of multiple personality disorder and DID a lot just because they've been discussed. So Daniel Goleman, the famous psychiatrist, talked about this guy named Timmy who had several different personalities. He was in a psychiatric hospital, and in one of them, he was named Timmy, and he was not allergic to orange juice. In all of the other personalities, he had terrible hives. But in that personality,
he didn't.
He didn't have orange juice. Huh. My example is more that when I go and do the Taekwondo kicks that I've been doing since I was 20 and taught by a world-famous master, I become a younger person. I become the younger me who can do crescent kicks a foot over his head. I have to be willing to get into that person. And that led to one of sort of the big breakthroughs of the book, which is that almost all of the literature on cells, which is all framed in the pathological version of people are ill and need to get together. Almost all of them talk about how cells happen during terrible, traumatic, often sexual, violent times when people are young and a cell splits off. Mm. Well, I was in a place called Port Charles in Virginia in the bay, just hanging out in the ocean, and it was a couple few hours, and I realized I was back in that self of mine that I created when I was 4 years old and went to the ocean every day of the summer with my parents. Mm. And you have positive cells. When I fell off a bike, and I didn't go on for 2 years, and then I got back on, I was like, oh my God, I love this invigorated, athletic, moving part of me. How could I not remember the part of me that's been riding since I was five? Mm. So, you know, your different cells can be substantially different. I mean, the part of me who's a writer and who has to sit in an office and work 40 or 50 hours in a week sometimes on projects, I have to make it so that that part of me can show up. He needs coffee, he needs certain sorts of food, he needs naps. If I make it possible for him to show up, things go a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah. So would you say that these subpersonalities are almost whole human beings in themselves or could be mistaken as such?
Well, it's not like you become different people. It's not like there are different people.
Yeah, because most psychologists would agree that there are behaviors and that, like, certainly in addiction issues, you're dealing with changing behaviors.
Right. Here's our definition. Cells are self-states, and that comes from Charlie Tart's work, and Charlie was working with somebody else.
Yeah.
And self-states are recurrent patterns of mind-body chemistry, energy, perception, and behavior in a human being. And one of my big new frames for understanding this is system science, because one of my clients that I write for in other areas is a systems scientist.
Yeah.
So when you start to think about attractive basins, networks, network attractors, you realize that most of the time, or most of the people I know, are in one of several cells. And they kind of usually go in and out of those cells. They're either usually in one or another. Now, there are some people who are said to have co-consciousness, and they're actually aware of being in more than one self at a time, but that's pretty rare.
Ah, is there kind of like the bridge of the Enterprise, where you have the captain of the ship and the crew around
it? Well, so one of the things that's interesting about this book and that's problematic is that if this is so obvious, why are we writing a book about it? And if psychosynthesis and voice dialogue and all of the rest look at this in detail, what are we adding that's any new or different? Why are we kind of even bringing this up right now?
Yeah, what's its value?
Like, why? And what we're saying is that at the core of psychology is a wrong assumption, the single self assumption. And it messes a lot of things up such that go ahead and apply Occam's razor, the principle of parsimony. Don't unnecessarily multiply explanatory entities. We explain so much with this about ordinary human life and behavior when you think about it, including why somebody's totally in love with someone in the night and in the morning, you know, you never hear from the person again, and including why people forget things. Mm. I tell things to my wife and partners, and they don't remember sometimes because the self that was there hearing didn't really hear, and that's what happens.
Yeah, it's so like partitioned memory or something.
Well, it's like that. And so when you realize that people in your life might be telling you things that they don't remember, it's not because they're messing with you. It's because that part of them isn't really here. What the book is it's kind of a tour de force, right? We look at language. We look at culture. We look at science. We look at neuroscience. We look at philosophy. We look at religion. We look at postmodernism, all in a lot of detail. And what you will see is that from novelists to cartoonists, we have about 8 real cartoons in the book, all these scientists, from Doug Hofstetter to the left brain, right brain guys, all these people, David Eagleman, and they all pretty much say, yeah, the reality is we have different selves. But as a general principle, the idea was completely buried in around 1910, and ever since, it only comes up in these very pathological contexts where people want to supernaturalize it. And we're going, No, this is the way it is. It's very kind of weird to think about the fact that you actually have different attractive basins that are running your body and what you're doing. But that's really what goes on with everybody that we've ever known.
Gabby just noted that most humans have 6,000 thoughts per day.
Right.
Can you identify which personalities or subpersonalities are with you at any given moment? Have you have tools for doing that, or is
you know, a couple of things about that. I realize that, first of all, well, there's an English author named Rita Carter who talks about majors, minors, and fragments. So you could argue that cells are at different levels, but, you know, and I did some work with my men's group about, we had a bunch of index cards, and everybody wrote out all their different cells and gave them names, and I think for some people, that could be really valuable. But I think it's more like, in my case, I had this experience of going to restaurants where sometimes I'm not seen and I don't get ordered.
Yeah.
And I realized that when I get stressed and triggered to a certain place, I become rude and not who I want to be. When I feel that self coming in, I don't try to stop it. I just leave. Because it's never been worth it to become the asshole that I'm capable of becoming. It's never worth it. So you talk about things like an Odysseus pact, right? Yeah. He got the guys on the ship to say, don't untie me, no matter what that self orders you when we get there. Yeah. And so you can do sort of similar things. I mean, one of our catchphrases is that mental health is being in the right mind at the right time. But again, it all starts with going that, wow, I really do have different functional centers of action, attention, and performance and behavior. You can spot them and you can name them, and a lot of people like doing that, but then they tend to give ones that do things that they don't like bad names, and actually we write a story about that in the book about a forgetful part of me that I kind of gave a bad name to, and it doesn't really help to denigrate parts of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure how helpful it is to know exactly what they are, and then you get into all sorts of things like reincarnational cells from past lives.
Yeah, trans-channeling is a kind of a...
All that stuff. And so we say, we list it, but we don't get to it because that's beyond our pay grade. And the other thing that is beyond our pay grade is a lot of the systems, at the end of the day, psychosynthesis, ISF, the mother, Gurdjieff, all of them, at the end of the day, they tell you that what you have to do is forge a single self with a capital S. We call it the super self captain because somebody describes it that way.
Mm.
And get that self to ride herd over and bring order to and control all your cells.
Yeah, really? Like a top-down male hierarchy?
Yeah. Or how about you have a super self that's always in charge and always knows everything and really should be the one you should try to learn how to always access. And in a lot of spiritual language, a lot of courses and teachers, they talk a lot about your true self and your one self. And what we say is that all these systems, including IFS and psychosynthesis, there may be a single self, one self to rule them all.
Yeah.
But again, we don't have enough evidence for that. That's beyond our pay grade. We think that the real rubber meets the road for most ordinary people is just getting that they really do have different selves. They actually are different in how they perform and what they're like when they're in them, and so are the people closest to them. If that's the real fact of the way things are, it's a very different world.
What about something as prosaic as getting high? Does that change the balance of selves? What happens when you get high?
I don't know what you mean. No, okay.
I just smoked some weed, for example.
Yeah, you know, Jim is famous for his work with psychedelic and microdosing, and we've tried to keep the two separate.
Separate worlds, okay.
What I can say from my own experience, and I don't think this will surprise you, is that when you're high, it's easier to access different selves and get stuck in them. So you got to be careful, yeah. Right? Yeah. So I don't know how much it changes. I mean, we like to frame all of Jim's work in terms of a focus on creativity, because that embraces sort of both. But, you know, a lot of the people we know, like our friend Christina, the artist.
Could you hold that thought about Christina for a second? We got to go to a commercial break. All right,
sure.
We're talking to Jordan Gruber on his new book, Your Symphony of Selves. Be right back.
Sure.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking to Jordan Gruber on his new book with Jim Fadiman on Symphony of Selves. Now, you were going to mention Katrina?
I'll read this a little bit. Visual artist Christina Lazar, and Christina helped illustrate my other book on rebound exercise, Bounce, once shared the following. When I was younger, she said, even in middle and high school, I knew there were a lot of people in there, a lot of different personalities that came out at different times. I would always think, this isn't cool. I'm disjointed and unfocused. I have to pick just one. So I deemed some of them bad or good, passed a lot of judgment on which one I should be, and even practiced squelching some of my inner people more than others.
Hmm.
I felt that way until fairly recently, but as part of learning to be okay with myself, I realized I am all of those inner people. I learned to recognize each of my personalities as their own person and to value what they could offer and give me as a whole. Now it's okay for me to be with all of myself. Instead of trying to squelch, trying to get rid of them, I honor them all for who they are and what they have to say to me. I love whiskey, art, science, sales, working out, fashion, and jewelry, and I love to make things and teach. All of these things and so much more are me. One of them without the rest isn't me. So I've been learning, working with, and sitting with each of them to see how they fit into the multifaceted overall totality of who I am. What a relief. Now I don't have to stress myself out anymore that I'm a bad person for not picking one thing and sticking to it my whole life. Now they can all talk to each other, and they have even become a kind of council for me to utilize.
She has a group. Well, who is this I of hers that is honoring all of herself, though?
Well, I think that's a linguistic fashion we have to.
We're used to thinking
from the I and the me. We do a lot with language in the book. There's all sorts of expressions that reflect the idea of multiplicity, and in my own correspondence with people, I find that I can work in the word myself with an S without flinching or anyone thinking it's weird. But if I start talking about me as we, people don't like it. It's
yeah,
just a little bit. It's just a little bit too much. So you kind of got to approach people where the idea sort of makes sense to them. Most people get that when with their old friends partying, they're not the same as when they're with their children or parents. They get that right away.
Hmm. What about legal implications of legal defense? You know, the devil made me do it takes on new meaning with this sort of...
Yeah, how's my connection? Are you hearing me sounding funny?
Yeah, you sound good. You sound good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so the book goes in several sections. We present what we're doing and then the benefits, and then we talk about... It's not a self-help book, but we offer a lot of models and metaphors for all the different ways that people have learned how to work with themselves. And what you ask? Sorry, I forgot.
Well, I'm saying, well, first of all, Mrs. Future here just gave me the many names for the selves, which is an interesting list that you guys put together.
Well, yeah. What's interesting is when John Rowan in England wrote a book in 1980 on this, he said, In my research, I found 25 names, and if there's comfort in numbers, then this proves there's something going on. But we now have more than 70 names, and that's just in English.
Alter egos, characters, complexes, crew, yourselves, your shoulder angels, sub-agents.
Complexes is interesting because it brings us back to Carl Jung and this. One of the most fun chapters in the book for people who are interested in the history of psychology is chapter 6, where we lay out this map of who influenced who and where did the idea start and then what happened. And you see that an awful lot happened in Paris in the 1880s, in the 1890s. Very many people came to study under someone who was known as the great Charcot, who you may have heard of.
Yes, he worked with Freud in hypnosis, I believe.
Well, basically, William James came to Paris and studied with him. Alfred Binet, who invented the intelligence test, or co-invented, came to study with him.
Yeah.
Pierre Janet came and studied with him. And Freud came and studied with him. They were all very influenced by what Charcot was doing.
Mm.
And in fact, in Freud's first paper with Joseph Breuer, he thanks Binet and the two Genets, Pierre Genet, the great theorist of dissociation, and his uncle Paul, for their work in this field. And later on, when Freud rejected what's called the seduction hypothesis, he also got rid of selves. So in 1905, there was a big conference on this topic of multiple selves at Harvard, with Pierre Genet invited, and it was a big deal.
Yeah.
By 1910, the Freudian wave had submerged everyone and everything, and this idea has not been presented in a positive context since.
I see. It's kind of like rationalism in science, where we threw out the intuitive and the shamanic elements of reality to express more the rational science point of view.
Yeah, kind of like a flat landing of it, or yeah, getting rid of all of, Wilford put it in terms of getting rid of all of the interior dimensions of reality.
So how does this symphony of selves address and rescue psychology with all of its limitations by the single self theory?
Well, we have offered, so I was trying to say before that the book then gets into a chapter where we look at the legal stuff. That was your question that I forgot.
Yes,
we look at the law, we look at
psychiatry,
and we look at, right, and so we go through a lot of that. There is a general agreement, and there are communities of people with the pathological version, and they've come up with like a code of ethics, and they all always agree that whatever you do with your body, you're responsible for. So it really doesn't change that level. There could be some complications, but our major attempt at a theoretical innovation comes from the notion that the term dissociation doesn't really mean anything. We deconstruct it in the appendix in great detail, and that we can rebuild psychology to take into account healthy multiplicity by using the concept of cohesion. Or really, how well does somebody hang together? How well do their parts hang together? And so like transpersonal psychology itself is always premised on a positive formulation of psychological reality, we want to build things up based on cohesion, which is in turn built on coherence, congruence, and compassion. So congruence means that whatever one of yourselves says, the other parts of yourselves have to do what it says. If you're not congruent to other people, it's very strange. And coherence refers to how well you're understandable. If yourselves are not cohesive, you're not going to be able to be understood, which is the coherence. And then we found that the more people realize they and other people have different selves, the more compassionate they can be towards themselves and other people. So if you do eat that other piece of cake, you go, it's okay, that part of me really was hungry, and I'm not going to make a big deal out of it. Or if, you know, wow, they forgot they agreed to that, but I guess I'm going to cut them a break, because if I go to myself that's most angry, it's going to be a bad night, and I don't want that.
So how does your theory deal with something like, say, an intentional pathological liar?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And early on in the book, for example, we took out all mentions of a certain person who's very much in the news, who everybody thinks is likely one of those. It's important to separate the pathological versions from ordinary normal people who have a variety of selves and have learned how to work with them. If you have a self that's a liar and that's a sociopath or has anti-personality social disorder of some kind, that's still going to be true, and it will be less cohesive and will cause more trouble for the person and for everyone in that person's life.
Well, maybe, or if you use, say, the Enneagram to think about, say, the 8 subpersonality type, which is a distrustful personality type that strategically tries to dominate people that are threatening and thus embraces a strategy of keeping others off balance for the sake of preserving their own authority. I'm just saying that when you get into a theory of embracing multiple personalities, it introduces a whole different ethical, moral reality. It's much more Machiavellian.
I'm not exactly following you how it's more Machiavellian, because different parts of you might not care.
Yeah, because the single self theory assumes that we can look to, say, people entrusted with leadership to have an ethical, moral basis, and yet we can understand that somebody who's in power may have not used their ethics to get to power.
Well, different parts of people are going to be more or less trustworthy. That's the reality. You have to take them for the whole of who they are. I don't think that's changed at all, other than recognizing that. I have an example of this. I was in law school, and I had a very close friend, and he gave a party at his house, and he got a little bit drunk, and he started hang out with these two people I didn't know that well. And he got kind of vicious towards me and attacked me. And I said, I won't use his name. I'll call him John. John, why are you? He said, this is the way I am. You better get used to it. And he was just like, he had so switched into that part of him that I realized that, you know, that was the way it was for him right then. And there was nothing I could do to change it. So it's just recognizing that not everybody's going to be cohesive at the same level. Not everybody is going to have as many healthy or not healthy cells. But our point, I guess, is that starting with basic notion that the single self assumption that you are always the same self or subpersonality persona, it's just wrong. It's just inaccurate, and it doesn't reflect the way we experience ourselves or other people. So by kind of looking to get underneath that assumption, you know, that's not to say that there isn't going to be a ton of work to actually integrate this view into Western culture.
Yeah, it's going to take a while.
We think it needs to be done, and that's why we do cover law, and we cover criminal justice, and we cover mental health. I mean, it's literally a paradigm shift, and that's why, even though we think it's completely obvious, people can't see it.
Now, if you have good internal multiplicity, does that mean you have good external connections with people as well?
I think usually, yeah. I mean, I don't think they necessarily go in lockstep, but sure, the more internally cohesive you are, the more you're going to be able to deal with all sorts of people in all sorts of situations. You know, I think we sort of already know how to do this, right? Like, when we go on this interview, we're both in a slightly different self than if you were here in my basement and we were hanging out, bouncing and getting high, right? It's a different world. So I think that people who are healthy and functional, for the most part, have already learned a lot of these lessons. It's just like the basic lesson that with a kid, when they're not in a teachable moment, you don't try to teach them.
Right.
They're not in a self that's going to learn something no matter what you do.
Yeah.
You might as well recognize that even though you think they should be able to get it, they're never going to get it. So you got to kind of take people where they are, and it brings more of a fluidity, and it's kind of in concert with postmodernism and what they're now calling in academia intersectionalism. Have you heard of that?
Intersectional? No, I haven't. No.
Intersectionalism is this notion that to really understand someone, you have to understand the part of them that is, you know, what their sexual orientation is and what their economic background is, and that, like, all of these life waves and currents and lines are actually concressing in real time in any given moment. But to radically be in their subjectivity is very difficult, and that's what we have to try to do with other people.
Gotcha. Okay, we got to go to a break. If any of you have any questions for Jordan Gruber on his new book, Your
Symphony
of Selves, give us a call at 831-479-1080, the final 15 minutes. Jordan, we'll be right back.
Yeah, running down a dream.
Welcome back to the show. I've got a couple of text questions in, and also we've got a caller on the line. The text questions, so hold on, Mike, we'll be right with you. One question for Jordan, is there any difference between the way men and women organize their subpersonalities? And have you found that there are any specific roles that the subs play, like mother, father, child, businessman, artist?
Well, we haven't focused on differences between men and women, but in terms of the roles people play, in the section on where selves come from and what are the different ideas, which goes from biology and anatomy to cells and all the way up to brains and all the way up to spirituality, we pretty much list all the roles that they give and say, you know, again, and there's a lot of overlap with sort of the different Jungian archetypes. So I don't think that men and women do this differently, but I don't know. They might.
Yes, I've heard different theories along those lines.
Women's are probably more complicated.
Everything's connected to everything, I think, in a female brain. Okay, we have a caller, Mrs. Future?
We do.
All right. Mike, you're on.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hi, guys. Hey, interesting show today.
Thank you.
Regarding the differences between men and women, a woman PhD wrote a book called The Female Brain, and it talks about how really different men and women's brains are. So you might find that interesting.
Okay.
There's a book called The User Illusion that talks about the vast amount of information that could be in your brain but won't fit. You can only get a little tiny fraction of what's going on inside you into your consciousness at any given time.
Hmm.
You guys heard of that?
The User Illusion. No, I haven't.
Yeah, really good. It might support some of what you're saying. The Moody Blues wrote a song called House of Four Doors, where they talk about
right.
the different drugs and how you can get stuck there forever. Have you heard of that, okay?
I'm a big
And
big
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were great, huh? My question is, I'm reading a book called Your Nostradamus Factor by Ingo Swann, the remote viewer.
Yes.
And he examined his mental process. Okay. Yeah, interesting guy, huh?
Perry.
He examined his mental processes very carefully, and he wanted to find any blocks he had to his own psi ability. So he did a pretty rigorous process, and part of that was he identified what were called anchor points in psychology and how they contribute to your mindset. And he said that each anchor point must be conscious to some extent because they form your mindset, which is like a semi-permeable filter. I'm wondering how anchor points or the mindset fits into your multiple personality idea. And I'll take my answer off here. Thank you.
Thank you,
well,
Mike.
You know,
great question.
Yeah, that's a great question. We just talk about mindsets. Actually, referring to people as having different mindsets is an easy way for them to start working with the idea in their own lives without them having to go all the way to, does that mean I have different people inside of me? So, yeah, I like the mindsets idea. And as far as the anchor points, it seems similar. It seems that we could have mentioned that in the chapter on the origins of self. So I'm familiar with a lot of the psi literature, and maybe I'll go back and look up, you know, Swann and see what he has to say about that.
Hmm. Well, what crossed my mind as Mike was posing his question is something that Charlie Friedman once said that stuck with me, which is you can hear a lot of things, but you will only retain information about those things that you are genuinely interested in, and everything else will just kind of go in one ear and out the other.
Right.
So this idea of anchor points being the parts of your personality that are fixed, that you have natural attention and natural cohesion, I guess, is what I found most interesting about that. And I guess the question is, how permeable or fixed are those parts of your personalities?
It also reminds me of Carlos Castaneda, you know, when Don Juan would whack him on a certain part of his back and shift the literal focus of attention in his whole energy body. So your question is a good one, and I don't really know the answer to it, but I did want to go back to what you said about the Enneagram for just a bit, because I had the experience recently of taking 180 intensive Enneagram questionnaire and finding out that I wasn't really a 7 with a 6 wing or a 6 with a 7 wing. I'm really a 4, and that was fine, and I see how it's true. But then this very detailed analysis showed certain levels of way I act when I'm not getting what I want, when I'm having conflict. So there are things like, are you competent? Do you have a positive reaction? Do you frame it positively, or do you get reactive? Unfortunately, I get reactive more than I should. And so when I was discussing this with the guy who gave me the course and who's a coach, at first I was saying, well, selves are better than I, and then I realized, no, the Enneagram is a great way for showing you how you move about between your different selves. There's definitely a lot of value in the way it has been constellated and the way it figures out. So I found that really useful,
mm-hmm.
and not at all in conflict with the idea that we have.
Do you have a chapter on the Enneagram in the book?
No, we do not have a chapter on the Enneagram in the book.
Okay.
I have a question come in for you. Can you invoke different subpersonalities at will?
Well, that is one of the things that you have to learn how to do. So the question is, if mental health is being in the right mind at the right time, what can you do to be more aware of when you are on that road to being switched or triggered as opposed to learning to shift on your own? And so it's not a self-help book, but we give a lot of self-help suggestions. And you can do things like rehearse scenarios in your head ahead of time. If something is going to happen, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to make up a rule that when I get upset in a restaurant, I just leave. Or you can do these kind of Odysseus pacts. Or you can just try to, it's not all that different than being mindful in general and just going, wow, I'm in a really nice space and I'm being, this trigger, this potential trigger is kind of eating at me. What am I going to do? Because if I get to the point where I'm triggered, then it's not going to be good. And we've all had that happen.
So are there specific goals for an individual to have in mind when they're integrating the Symphony of Selves?
I guess.
Psychological goals?
Yeah, they want to have a good life, right?
Early on, what we said was that when people realize that they have different selves and begin to take it seriously and work with it, even a little bit, their life tends to work better and things tend to be easier. It's not the kind of thing you just pop into and stay there forever. Certainly, I haven't been able to do that.
What about people like Robin Williams? You know, you start talking a different accent and you get into a different character of yourself. You know, is there anything to that?
Yeah, I think so. And just like there's, we do have a bit about how people in different languages, both in terms of how they feel and report it in EKGs,
yeah,
they move into different cells. If, you know, we have one guy saying when he's his Israeli talking in Hebrew, he's much harsher with his kids than when he's talking to them in English.
Huh.
So, you know, I think there's a zillion, literally, different ways to begin working with this. For everyone, it's going to be different. But because the single self assumption is so prevalent everywhere, it's like, remember when McKenna used to talk about monotony, monogamy, and monotheism?
Yeah.
This is sort of similar in that, you know, you get one God, one soul, one self. That's it. That's the limit. You can't have more than that. And we're just saying, let's just see why. What the shoulder angels exist in so many different areas. And originally that's actually, it comes from the Romans, and then it was modified by the Arabs in like the 1300s.
Yeah.
So why is it in so much language? Why does Tevye go on the one hand, on the other hand, on the other hand? Why does the Big Bang Theory talk about the Council of Sheldons? Why does Star Trek have the singing vase that has all these different people from all these different, that have to be integrated or they're not a whole person? It's in so much. And it was in BoJack Horseman, plain as day. Yeah, there was this line, you know, nobody's just one of us. There's a great multiplicity that lives in all of us. Mm. So what we're saying is that the reason this is popping up in everything from Kathy and Dilbert to James Thurber and David Bowie is because that's actually how we are. We've just ignored it for a very long time. And the longer something that's out of sync with the way things are goes on, it's like the epicycles they made to justify keeping the Earth in the center. Eventually, it broke down. Mm-hmm. And what we're saying is now a lot of people are getting this in a lot of ways, in a lot of areas, and we think it's time to go back to 1890 American psychology.
So embrace our subpersonalities. Mm-hmm. So can different subpersonalities be divergent in beliefs? Like, can one believe in God?
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole point. They sometimes have different opinions, different agendas, and that's why reading the Billy Milligan book, if you ever get the time, by Daniel Keyes, is such a fabulous book.
Billy Milligan.
And I believe they also have different entelechies. You know, the entelechy of an acorn is to become an oak. Your different selves might not be that in alignment with each other, and that makes it even more important for, you know, you to open up communication lines with them. And, you know, all this obviously happens internally and not necessarily like you're writing letters or trying to do focused meditations. It's more of a generic gestalt approach to who we are and who the people we're interacting with are.
Yeah, one thing that is crossing my mind too is the metaphor of the multiplicity of selves with the idea of humanity as a planetary mind, as a planetary brain, and having a multiple of selves that all need to come into coherence for a planetary consciousness, you know,
yeah,
as
exactly.
above, so below.
Right. So if you learn to work with your own selves better and the people in your immediate world, it'll be easier for you to deal with everyone in your life.
What about epigenetics? Different aspects of yourself trigger off different beliefs and control over even physical processes?
Yeah, it's back to the guy being allergic to orange juice or not.
Yes.
There's some interesting research that we cite, but not a lot of detail, because the people who don't believe in it will never believe in it.
Yeah.
There's different research about like eyeglass prescriptions changing, medications changing, people being taller.
That's one way of dealing with disease, right? To switch.
There is so much to tap in these mysteries.
Yeah, we got to go, unfortunately. But if people want to know more, Jordan, where do you suggest they go?
YourSymphonyOfSelves.com. Well, we're still building a new website, but that'll take you to Amazon, and there's a lot already there. And we'll be having a blog and a lot of stuff coming up.
Okay, fantastic. YourSymphonyOfSelves.com. Very good.
Well, thank you so much for having me, guys.
Yeah, thanks, sir. Very, very intriguing topic.
Yeah.
I invite you to explore your own selves.
Yeah, yes. Well, we'll read the book for starters.
All right.
All right. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody. This is the Dr. Future Show, KSCO Santa Cruz. Thanks, everybody who called. And